You're listening to the Conroll Cast. Reviews of scary movies, interviews with cool people, and my mommy and daddy.
Due to some violent content, parental discretion is advised.
Hey guys, it's Michelle back for yet another episode of the Conduit Cast, and I actually got a couple things accomplished for this podcast. Finished reading my Joel Hill book, which I'll talk about later, and went to see Scream 4 last night, and let me tell you, I am pissed off at Wes Craven, but I'll get into that a little bit later. And yes, really, what did I expect? But I had high hopes, and my hopes and dreams were flushed on the frickin' commode with that turd of a movie. Anyhow, I'll rant about that a little bit later. I do want to say one thing, and this is in regards to anybody who reads The Walking Dead. What in the flip happened with issue 83? I mean, hello, Kirkman, I swear to God, if you go where I think you're going to go, I am burning all of my books. I'm burning them all. I don't care how many volumes I have, because I am going to hunt you down and slap the shit out of you, because I can't even believe that you went there. I mean, really, like volume 8, the trade wasn't bad enough. Now this, oh. Anyhow, for those of you who know what I'm talking about, it was insane. And my jaw actually was sitting there. My comic Yoda Chris had told me about this. And she's like, you know, you have to read it as quick as you can. So I can't always get the bent Wookiee as much as I like to. But I finally got there. And this was like, I think it was last week. And I'm sitting outside the comic shop. And I promised her I would text her as soon as I read it. So I'm reading along. And some crazy shit happens. And I get to the last page. My jaw actually dropped. And I sat there stunned for quite some time, and then I was mad, and then I had to text her, and we were going back and forth, but that's some good times there. And also I wanted to say that I will be contributing here and there to a website called Horror Happy Hour, and that is with Chris and Dave C., the two horror-powered duo couple, I guess you would say. Kind of like the podcast. I mean, I'm going to contribute when I can. I did a review of Craven's My Soul to Take and kind of skewered him, and I actually felt a little bit bad afterwards because it was kind of harsh, but you know what, after the movie last night, I don't care. I should have been harder on him. So if you get a chance, head over there, because it just is going to be one of those things when I get time I can contribute. But there's a lot of really great reviews and articles and stuff, all kinds of stuff for you to check out over there. Interviews and that sort of thing. So, anyhow, I'll be back in a little bit to go on my rant of all things Craven and talk a little bit about Joel Hill. So, I'm going to turn you over to Chris, and I'll talk to you in a little bit.
Thank you, Michelle. It's good to be back. It's good to have you in with another segment. Things keep moving right along. I apologize with the inside feature-length commentary, but whenever I can get a segment from Michelle, I'm going to use it. So that still is in the wings and in the works and coming along. But just a couple housekeeping issues here. Strangely enough, I'm recording this on Wednesday, May 4th, which also happens to be mine and my wife's wedding anniversary. I'm at home recording, and she's hard at work. So quite a romantic day for us, but I want to say a happy anniversary. We've been together a little over 9 years and been married for 8. So quite an accomplishment. And also something I just realized when I was going through some back episodes, I'm trying to get all the past podcasts up to the website. We just celebrated the 1 year anniversary of the Conduit Cast back on the 26th of April. So, happy anniversary to Michelle as well. I get to celebrate two anniversaries with two different women. But other than that, we're gonna get into some movies here in a second. There's a lot of content that's been put up and added over at theconduitspeaks.com. So please, you know, check that out. And you can email me over at theconduitcast@gmail.com or call on our voicemail line, 206-339-1819. And outside of that, there's just I don't often do this anymore, but I feel like I kind of been slacking because there are three people I want to draw some attention to and have you guys seek out if you're not already listening to them over on iTunes. And that's Body Count Podcast, who are always doing a great job and just a lot of fun and fantastic listen. The Horrorcore Podcast, that one I like in particular because needless to say, it's a very open and honest show, and I like that Bart pulls no punches and definitely shares his views and opinions, and they're well informed, and he's also a great listen. And then of course, again, over on iTunes, you can check out Gruesome Herzog, a good friend, and he does, you know, his quick hit reviews, which is always fun. So I'm going to go ahead and get into the first two films that I'm going to be talking about, and then we're going to hear from Michelle, who has a bit of a rant that's rather near and dear to my heart. But first, I'm going to get into a 1990 film known as Begotten, and this is quite an interesting little exercise, to say the least. The director of this film, you might know him. His name is E. Elias Merhaj, I believe you say it, but you know I'm terrible with names. But he's also the director of Suspect Zero and Shadow of the Vampire, which are two films I like. Shadow of the Vampire a bit more so. But if I hadn't read some of the stuff from the director about this film, I would have no idea what was going on, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. The film opens up with God, essentially, image of God disemboweling himself, cutting himself open, guts spilling everywhere, and once he's died, Mother Earth climbs out of his body and revives the body, not to get too graphic, and uses God's semen to impregnate herself. Once Son of Earth is born, he begins to wander off on his own and comes across these faceless beings. He pukes up some flowers and seeds. They accept them as a gift. They bring the man, Son of Earth, to a fire and burn him alive, and he is resurrected, whereas he and Mother Earth reunite. The strange people show up again. They rape and murder Mother Earth. Her son is left kind of to mourn over the body, and the groups carry her off and dismember her and bury her remains and do the same with her son, and then the burial site starts sprouting beautiful flowers and a nice lush garden, which, yeah, I just said all that. The real cool thing about this is when and if you are able to watch it. Visually, it's black and white, but it's really grainy and kind of, you know, hyper stylized and oversaturated. And it's not because there wasn't time put into it. The interesting thing about this is there was 8 to 10 hours of re-photographing, visual treatments, and filtering for each minute of film. So the total time to re-photograph and basically work over this film optically was 8 months for the 78-minute runtime. It is very graphic, and in many ways, I don't think the fact that it's done in black and white really changes much of that or makes it any less disturbing or muted. But in and of itself, I mean, there's no dialogue. There's a pretty haunting score and soundscape that goes with it. And it's just a strange, weird, interesting little art experiment, if you will. Again, the narrative's muddy, so it's very helpful to know kind of what's going on before you see it, in a way. And it's, to me, very well executed symbolic illustration of kind of the gruesome side of the circle of life. I quite liked it. It's certainly not for everyone. I would say probably it would only take you 5 or 10 minutes into the film to know if you wanted to continue, because the narrative and its course stays pretty true throughout. So it's not something that you're going to waste, you know, 80 minutes of your life on. I would say watch 5 or 10 minutes of it. And if you're not, you know, jiving with it, if you're not feeling it by that time, you're not going to feel it at all. So that's Begotten from 1990. And I'm going to give that a 7 out of 10 as we move on into our second film, which just so happens to be 2010 Super, written and directed by James Gunn. The thing that I remember James Gunn for most is his horror comedy, Slither, which I absolutely love. And that one had me pretty excited for Super and had been getting some good buzz, so I was ready to sit down and watch it. Essentially, it centers around Rainn Wilson's character, whose name is Frank, and his wife, played by Liv Tyler. They're drifting apart, and she finally leaves him, which crushes Frank, who's already pretty much a pussy and a pathetic excuse for a person. Just kind of your run-of-the-mill, everyday sad sack. So he kind of goes into a downward spiral, finds out that his wife is once again using drugs. She was a drug addict who had been in recovery and had been turning her life around, and now she's hooked up with Jacques, played by Kevin Bacon, who's kind of feeding her drugs and keeping her close to him. So Frank, like I said, snaps, and inspired by the totally wasted, in my opinion, Nathan Fillion, the Holy Avenger. He's inspired by this Christian superhero to fight crime and in the process try and get his wife back. And Ellen Page is also in the film. She plays Libby and the Crimson Bolt's sidekick, Bolty. Once she finds out Frank's secret identity, being that she works in a comic book store and adores superheroes, she convinces Frank to let her be his sidekick, and they go on a crime-fighting spree together. And this film was very strange in that it has so many shifts in its narrative style and also its content. It goes from being a comedy to a drama to a splatter film to an action film to back to slapstick comedy. It's just the tonal shifts are very dramatic and really frequent. When I said that Nathan Fillion is wasted as the Holy Avenger, I think that becomes even more glaring because Rainn Wilson is just really not funny when he's supposed to be funny. He's not endearing when he's supposed to be endearing, and he's not pathetic when he's supposed to be pathetic. His whole performance is very wooden, and there definitely could have been a different device used to inspire Frank rather than this stupid fucking Holy Avenger, and it put Nathan in Rain's place. The whole thing just feels really rushed, and I'm all for the violence in this. When the violence does happen, it's very hardcore, which is refreshing to see from a superhero film. It's pretty gory, it's pretty gruesome, and it's done pretty well. Ellen Page as Libby in Bolte is just fantastic. She's hit or miss for me, but the stuff that I like her in, I really like her in, and this plays to all her strengths. I mean, she is silly, she's strange, she's quirky, she's emotionally and mentally disturbed. When she's on the screen, you can't look away and you can't help but have a good time. Everybody else kind of goes through the motions. Michael Rooker's in this, who I absolutely love, and he's wasted. He plays, you know, like just a third-rate thug with nothing to do. So overall, you know, it was pretty... I'm not going to say I didn't like it or I hated it. It was disappointing. And for as much as was going on in the film at times, it really bored me to death. Mostly when, as I said, Ellen Page wasn't on screen. So I'm going to give Super a 5 out of 10. I think it's a film that could swing either way for anybody. And I will not be watching this again, but the main reason that I just don't want to totally discount it is because of Paige's performance. So, you know, with that being said, recommend it? I would say yes, only because I think there's a lot of elements here that are going to appeal to a lot of different people. So that is Super. And we're going to kick it over to Michelle. Can't wait for you to hear her segment, and I'll be back with the last two movies.
But to get that boy up on the stand and watch him raise his red right hand.
Okay, guys, it's Michelle. Back to flap my gums a little bit more about some Craven stuff and some Hill stuff. And let me just start by saying I have a really, really bad habit of sounding like I'm saying Joel Hill. It's actually Joe Hill. So I don't know if it's just my way I talk or whatever, but it's actually Joe, J-O-E, Hill. But I found that I keep saying Joel Hill, and it sounds like Joel. So anyhow, sorry about that if I confused anybody. So let me go off a little bit about Mr. Wes Craven. Okay, Mr. Craven... Please, please quit making movies. I'm begging you on my hands and knees. Please, for the love of God and all that's holy, stop. Please. Because you have just... give it up. You have no talent left. And yes, I'm being a little harsh. Actually, no, I'm not being harsh. Because you know what? While this ass clown goes out and makes all of this crap, okay, for however much money they pump into it, there are tons of movies that are not getting the recognition and the money they deserve, and I am so sick and tired of this shit that is being pumped into the theaters and freaking fed to us like we're brain-dead retards. Oops, I guess I shouldn't have said that. Excuse me if anybody's offended by the word, but, yeah, we're not idiots. We actually like good movies, so please... For the love of Pete, Hollywood, put out something that we actually give a shit about, okay? Oh my gosh, I don't even know where to begin. First, let me begin with the piece of shit, the Craven called Cursed, okay? And I love werewolves, so we've been through this before, I love werewolves. So, you know, I kept hearing about this curse was getting shelved and... It was having trouble and yada, 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 and it took a long time to actually be released. And there is a reason why it was a total piece of freaking shit. Okay? There was not one good thing about that movie. The actors all sucked. The whole story sucked. Okay? Even the werewolf sucked. I mean, really? Ugh. So, okay. Well, you get a little pass on that, Craven, because you did do some pretty good shit, you know? Actually, you know what? Now, I take that back. Now that I think back, there's probably only two or three movies of Craven's that I really, really liked. So, actually, maybe I really don't like Craven all that much now, going back into his whole history. So, it starts with Cursed. The other movies I could at least tolerate, you know? They were tolerable, I guess. Or tolerable. I better get my English right here, but they're tolerable. So, off with Cursed. Okay. Well, whatever. Now, I am a huge fan of Scream. Well, I don't want to get into Scream first. Let me go next to My Soul to Take. For anybody that wasted the hundred-some minutes of your life watching this piece of freaking shit, okay? I made the mistake of renting this on demand for $5, so here's stupid me. Oh, I couldn't find anything to watch one night, so I'm going to give this My Soul to Take a chance. Yet again, another movie that he had trouble getting, you know, through, and it hit all these speed bumps, and it was shelved, and once again, guess what? It was like Cursed. He should have left it on the freaking mother-effing shelf, okay? Let it there, Craven. It was there for a reason. So, this movie starts with this guy. I'm not even Googling. I'm not even typing into my browser to bring this stuff up, because I watched it a couple weeks ago, so I'm going to go from memory. I refuse to even type the words to this into my computer to let anybody think that this is being looked up. So, excuse me if I forget some names here, but it starts with this guy who's actually really confusing in the beginning. I was all over the place, but there's this guy, and basically he's having, like, headaches or whatever, and he finds this knife, and they're, like, while he's watching the news, there's a story about this killer who's the Ripper, and, like, he finds this knife, just magically, like, falls, and sees this knife, you know, that's the Ripper's knife under his workbench. Oh, how freaking convenient was that, really? So, long story short, he slaughters his pregnant wife, and his daughter sees all of this, and he goes to kill her, and the EMTs come, and yada yada. The Ripper had taken 7 lives at this point, okay? So this is, like, crucial to the quote-unquote plot of this movie. So he had taken 7 lives, and conveniently, they load him up in the ambulance, and off they go, and what does he do in the ambulance? Of course, causes all kinds of havoc, and the ambulance wrecks, and the stretcher that he was on goes flying out, and they don't know whether he's dead or alive, or whatever the hell happened to this freaking dick. He's out there somewhere, dead, alive. Who the hell knows, and who cares? Now, at the same time this happens, there are 7 babies who are born prematurely in the hospital. Okay, they weren't due, and they're all born prematurely. So, fast forward like 16 years later or some shit, and they're all at some Ripper party where they're called the Riverton 7. Oh, what a clever name. It was the Riverton 7. So the Riverton 7 meet up and are having this ceremony where every year one of the 7 is chosen to attack a large puppet of the Ripper. And I'm not even kidding, it is a large puppet that comes out, and if they don't kill it, he, like, there's some curse or something, I don't know. But this kid who's named Bug, and let me tell you about the names of the characters in this movie. We have Bug, and we have, what the hell is a girl's name? Fang. Oh yeah, Bug and Fang. That was just, I don't know if that was Craven trying to think that he was, like, hip to the cool kids' names or something? I don't know. Oh, that irritated me. So, Bug goes to attack this Ripper, and he freaks out, and it doesn't happen, and the cops come, and now I guess this pissed off the Ripper, his spirit or something. I don't know. It's so confusing. And now everybody starts being attacked by this Ripper guy. You know, they think he's come back from the dead or some shit. So these Riverton 7 start dropping like flies, and there are other, like, subplots in here that make absolutely no sense and are so stupid. Ooh, I cannot believe I paid money to see this piece of crap. So, yeah. Anyhow, long story short, the predictable ending, you know, the person you figure is going to be the Ripper, like, reincarnated, because it was like a multiple personality thing, the first Ripper. So, of course, you know, his soul has gone into another person or something stupid like that. And, yeah, the ending was horrible. It was just, ugh. Just even thinking about it again, I'm getting a headache, because I was so pissed off when I watched that piece of crap. Actually, it took me, I will actually say that it took me 6 times, because I had this for like 2 days, and I kept falling asleep. So, it took me 6 times trying to get through this piece of shit, and Who knows why? Why I just didn't give up, I don't know, but I was trying to see if there was something salvageable in this piece of garbage, but there wasn't. So I was pretty pissed off at Craven about that. And I thought, well, you know what? I love the first Scream. I really do. And I give him a lot of credit for that. I really think it gave the slasher film some credibility again. Because, you know, after the 20,000 Jason movies and all of the B movies and everything from the 80s, it really gave the slasher flicks a bad name. And everybody was making a slasher flick back then. I mean, it was just, they were so just flooding the market, and none of them were any good, you know. So when he came out with his first Scream, I really loved it. I loved everything about it. I mean, it was just something that kind of took me back, and I still love it to this day. I think it's one of those movies that really holds up. So when Scream 2 came out, I was semi-excited because I was hoping he didn't go down the route of Jason and go to 25,000. But Scream 2 was all right. Scream 3 was like, meh, yeah, okay, really, you need to stop now. So it flash forward however many years, it's been quite a long time since the last Scream, and word of Scream 4 coming out excited me, because I really like the original cast. I love Neve Campbell as Sydney. I think she's a great actress, and she does such a good job as the fighter. You know, she kicks ass and fights back. And you have Courtney Cox and David Arquette and some usual characters from the first one. So it was good to see them come back, but the movie was awful. I mean, honest to God, at first it starts off, and Craven has the audacity in his movie to rip on Saw 4 and talking about how there's no plot development, and it's not character-driven, and it's torture porn, and, you know, like, this is one of the characters in this, you know, from the Stab movie. They call it, instead of Scream, it's Stab in this movie. And I'm thinking to myself, really? Who do you think you are, Mr. Craven, to be cutting up somebody else's horror movie when yours suck? Okay, granted, I don't like all of the Saws. I like the first one, and I don't know, there's another one in there somewhere that I liked. I can't even remember which one it is, because it's been a while since I saw it, but anyhow. He has really no room to talk. I mean, who in the hell do you think you are? Really? Shut the hell up. So, you know, the characters go on, and you meet Sydney's cousin and her forgettable friends, and it goes from there. You know, here comes Ghostface, killing everybody. You have to guess who the killer is, and it goes on remakes. Like, the whole premise of this movie is the killer is remaking the original Stab and trying to redo some of the original kills and do them in a new and better way or whatever. There was one really good kill in here and involved somebody who had their intestines kind of lying out, which really kind of gave me high hopes for this. And it just went downhill from there. I mean, really, there's one part where someone gets stabbed in the head, and they wind up wandering around, and then as they fall to their death, they give out a one-liner, and I absolutely hate that. I mean, it wasn't funny. It was completely uncalled for. You know, either you're going to go down the horror-y route or you're not, and he couldn't even get down that route, because it wasn't funny at all. There were no funny aspects to this film. The characters really annoyed me, and the actors, I don't know if it's because I'm such a big fan of the first one, but honestly, ugh, these people were just very hard to watch. To me, it just kind of jumped all over. The ending, to me, was predictable. I guessed who it was, one of the people. And it was really no surprise there. But I left the theater madder than hell because I spent $17 to go watch that piece of shit. I took my oldest son to see it. Now, he's a big fan of he's not a horror fan per se, but he's funny because he likes certain horror flicks. Like, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre scares the crap out of him, because when he was about 3, I was watching the remake, and he happened to walk out. It was like 3 in the morning, and he happened to walk out, and Leatherface was running around, and it kind of scarred him for life. So I felt bad for the poor little guy. So obviously, he hates the Texas Chainsaw, but he loves Freddy, and he loves Jason, and he loves the Scream series. So I thought this would be something, you know, we could kind of bond together over the horror, because we don't get much to bond over with horror, because he's not into the comics or anything, which kind of breaks my heart a little bit. I thought it'd be, you know, good to take him, and he liked it. I mean, he really had a good time, and I had a good time with him, because he jumped quite a few times. I mean, any of us seasoned horror veterans are going to know when the jump scares are going to be coming. So, I guess, in my opinion, this movie is good for 10-year-olds. Yeah, that's who should like this. 10-year-old boys. Because, let me tell you, anybody who has any kind of taste or loves this genre at all is going to want to choke this man half to death when they get out of the theater. And I could be wrong, maybe people are going to go there and love it, but I... And I texted Chris after I went, and He said, you know, I'm not going to say I told you so, but he said, I am going to tell you, you should have known better. And he was right. I mean, you know, he reviewed the movie without even seeing it, and he hit the nail right on the head because it was that bad. So I was really disappointed. Like I said, I really had high hopes for that, and I shouldn't have done that. I just kind of let myself down. So, Mr. Craven, I would like back the money that I spent to rent Cursed, which was $3, okay? I would like the $17 back I spent on that shit ball movie, Scream 4. I won't even ask you for the reimbursement for the freaking popcorn and shit. But maybe gas money would be nice, because $3.85 a gallon, like, I had to go, like, 25 miles to see this piece of crap, so we could figure in gas mileage there, so much per mile. And then the $5 I spent on My Soul to Take, I'm not asking for a whole lot, but I work my ass off for my money, and I will be damned if you're going to release pieces of shit and think that it's okay to keep doing this to us horror fans. Go away. We don't want you anymore. If you can't release anything that is worth watching, go away and let us alone. Actually, if you want to do something, what you need to do is you need to front some of these up-and-coming directors that can't get any money for anything. We would love you if you would do that. Stand behind Perry Teo and get the hell out of the way. Just give him your money. And Chris Power. You know, give them your money and go away. You could be like executive producer or something. We would be so happy if you would do that. Oh, and another thing that bothered me in this movie is the fact that, like, one of the lines in this movie was, one thing you're going to learn about the remake is don't fuck with the original. That was their line. And I was thinking to myself, really? Okay. Who are you to talk? Because in reality, as your, you know, touted movie, Last House on the Left, was a remake of The Virgin Spring. I mean, to anybody who's ever seen that, obviously knows that's where you got your inspiration from. Maybe it's not like a solid remake of it, but you didn't have an original idea with that there, buddy. So shut the hell up and go away, please. Oh, I feel so bad because I shouldn't even rant about this. I should just shut up. But honest to God, anybody who's thinking of seeing Scream 4, I would wait till it comes out on DVD. Anyhow, I guess that's enough ranting. I just had to get that off my chest. You know, like I said, I don't know what I was expecting, but I shouldn't have gotten my hopes up on that one. So that was a horrible theater-going experience. But now on to Joe Hill, tried to say that a little better, who happens to be the son of Stephen King. And one thing about Mr. King is I grew up with him in the 80s. I mean, he scared the freaking crap out of me, man. I remember finding the Night Shift book up in my mom and dad's attic. I was about 12, and I'd never read anything horrific. I had watched movies and everything, but I had, you know, never really delved into books. And this was the version that had the cutout cover. I don't know if you guys remember how they used to do the cutout cover. It's like there would be like the holes in the front, and you would see something, and you'd open it up, and it would be different from what you would think it would be. So this had like a couple cuts, you know, taken out of the cover, and you saw some eyeballs. And then when you opened up the cover, it was a hand wrapped in gauze with eyeballs on it. So I was like, ooh, this is pretty cool looking. So I dug this out of my mom and dad's attic and read it. And holy freaking shit. This book affected me in so many ways. The Boogeyman, let me tell you, I lived up and was surrounded by the attic. Like the attic, there were two doors to the attic, and then the attic connected in the back. And I had this little room that was surrounded by the attic. You went up the steps, and it was like the very top of the house. You went up the steps, there was my room, and off to the left was a freaking door to the attic, and off to the right was a door to the attic. And not only that, I had no door on my closet. And let me, I'm going to say, I have closet door issues. Like, I cannot stand a closet door hanging open. So, to anybody who has read The Boogeyman, you're going to understand why the whole closet thing scared the crap out of me. This book really, really deeply affected me and cemented my love for King. I mean, from that point on, I rabidly, like, searched out anything that he did. And as it got into the 90s, you know, we got It, which was monumental to me. I used to read that every summer. But as the years have gone on, his writing has just kind of, to me, gone downhill. And I know there are really rabid King fans, and I used to be one of them, that no matter what he did, I would defend him. Because I still, even to this day, even though I'm upset with his books, I still buy the books because I have all of them, so I'm not going to stop collecting them now. But when it came to the book sell, it was, honestly, it was so horrible. I couldn't even finish reading it. Like, I was so mad at that book, I just wanted to burn it and then tell him I wanted my money back. but I thought, okay, I'll let it go. And just from there, to me, it seems like the past decade, in my opinion, his writing has... He's just lost his heart and his soul for this genre. And I think he needs to just walk away for a while and maybe come back or not come back at all. I mean, you know, he's still the king of horror. Retire and just shut the hell up, you know, and quit writing. Kind of like Craven. You guys can retire together and go off and, you know, support other people who are better than you now and give some fresh blood to the genre. You know what I mean? Because it's really frustrating to me, too, that King keeps attaching his name to everything under the sun. Like, now he's possibly going to write a episode of The Walking Dead. Like, what? Stay away from that. Like, get away from me. Don't even go near The Walking Dead. Just let it alone, you know? I do have deep respect for the man. Why can't he... Here's my biggest issue with him. He is one of these people that spouts his political views off, and it really gets under my skin because I honestly can't stand actors and actresses and these famous people and King going out there and spouting off about politics and who we should vote for and what their views are. You know what? I don't care. Okay? I could care less who you vote for because that doesn't sway my opinion at all. And I feel that you need to just shut the hell up and concentrate on your craft and not the politics of the world, you know? Either get in politics or get the hell out and shut up. So that's really frustrating to me, and he's really been flapping his gums a lot lately, and I'm really tired of it, so that's one of the reasons I'm pissed off at him, other than his crappy writing. But I happened to discover his son Joe's graphic novel series, Lock and Key, and this was before I even knew he was King's son. I had no clue. But somebody told me about the Lock and Key series, and it is amazing. I mean, his artwork is brilliant. And the story is just incredible. I mean, the story and the artwork go together so beautifully. And I wound up buying the first volume in hardback. And it is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. It's a beautiful hardback. And it has this cool little, like, clothy type of bookmark type of thingy. And it's really, really great. So it's definitely something if you want to check out Hill's writing. It would be something to do. I think I found mine on, this was before I knew about Bent Wookie. I found my copy on Amazon for like $9 or something. So that's how I collect mine. I actually don't get the monthlies for Lock and Key. I wait till the hardback comes out. Anyhow, from Lock and Key, it really piqued my interest with him. And, you know, somebody had told me about his book, Heart Shaped Box, and I bought it, and it took me a long time to get to it because I just don't have that much time to delve into a book. So I got Heart-Shaped Box, and once I started reading it, he put me so much in the mind of his dad with his writing that it just, I got sucked right into that book, and it just carried me right along. Now, the ending, like, to me, I like the ending, but there are a couple things that I would change with the ending personally, but I mean, I'm not a writer, so, you know, I need to shut the hell up about that. But it was a really good book all in all. I really liked the characters in it, and I thought it was a great story. And it gave me the heebie-jeebies a couple times because it deals with a haunted suit that the main character buys online. Like, somebody had sent him an email about this haunted suit. So he buys the suit, and it gets sent to him, and it says, you know, my grandfather will come with this suit, and yada yada. So the suit comes, and it's in a heart-shaped box. Sure enough, he starts to see this old man around, and things progressively get worse, and his life gets turned upside down. So it's definitely a good read. Now, from there, I went to 20th Century Ghosts. Now, I went there because I read the one-shot comic, The Cape, which The Cape, the comic, has nothing to do with The Cape, the TV show, and The Cape, the comic, is actually about a man who, like, in the beginning, it shows him as a child, and he had a blanket that his mom, like, sewed a lightning stripe or something on, and he was up in the tree, and his brother was tanning him, and the tree branch broke, and for just, like, a second or two, with his cape, he was able to fly and stay off the ground, and then, you know, eventually, over time, he lost track of where the cape was at, and he finds it when he's older. And the ending of this comic, I loved it. It was so good. I can't say anything about it because it would give the whole thing away. But once I realized that the cape was actually based on his short story, The Cape, from 20th Century Ghosts, well, I was all over that. 20th Century Ghosts is an incredible book. To me, it's my favorite book that he's done so far because I love short stories. Like, in my mind, his dad, one of his strong points was hitting you with a short story, because, man, that man could pack a punch with his short stories. And his son has really inherited that gift. some of them are kind of oddball. Sometimes these writers like write about something and you're kind of like, were they high when they wrote this or on crack or something? Because it doesn't make any sense. But there's one story called Last Breath, and it deals with a doctor who has a whole collection of people's last breaths and the things that they've said in these jars, and you can go along and listen to them, and it has a really good outcome. And then there is one, I think it was called Abrams Boys. I don't have the book in front of me right now, so I'm hoping I got the name of that right. Basically, it's about two boys who their father happens to be Van Helsing, and you find out in the story, and they are kind of rebelling against his crazy notion that, you know, the vampires are out there to get them and everything, and it ends on a pretty good note. So this one was chock full of, actually, like, had a heartwarming story in it. It had some kind of like off the wall stories, and it had a good couple horror stories in there. And then his third book is called Horns, and what it deals with is this man who wakes up one day. His name's Iggy, and Iggy wakes up one day and he has a set of horns in his head, and they're just little nubs when they start, but as the day progresses and the days progress, the horns get bigger. He starts to get like red skin. He starts to resemble the devil, and the whole mystery unfolds of why this has happened, and a little bit of background into the girl that he loved. Her name was Marin. And it is really a good ride because it takes you in a couple different heartbreaking twists and turns, and there is one unexpected turn towards the end, and it really kind of broke my heart a little bit because I really like the characters in this book. But from what I was reading on FearNet one day, Horns is actually already slated to become a movie. Now, I personally myself would have picked Heart-Shaped Box to become a flick before I picked Horns, but to each his own, because Horns is a good novel. But I would probably rate them as 20th Century Ghosts, and then Heart-Shaped Box, and then Horns. I mean, that's how I would rate them, just for my own personal taste. So, for those of you who like King and like to branch out book-wise, his son, Hale, will actually really put you in the mind of the early King. He definitely inherited his dad's talent, and I really hope he goes far and keeps pumping this stuff out, because I am definitely hooked on him like I was his dad, and I'll keep collecting his books too. I have a little collection of father and son, I guess. I guess that's it for this week's podcast. I've already yapped on long enough. My ranting about Craven, and I do feel bad. I mean, I hate to get all negative and go on like that, but I just get frustrated sometimes, and I know you guys feel the same way, that when we see movies that we love just can't get released or can't get any kind of backing, and this garbage is put out in theaters, and it's, you know, we're supposed to take this. I mean, it's just so old and tired, and I don't know. I've lost all faith in that kind of anything good coming out of Hollywood. Well, I shouldn't say that, because The Last Exorcism was the last really good movie-going experience I had. I went to the theater to see that, and I loved it, and Drag Me to Hell. Those are two movies I've seen in the past couple years that I absolutely loved. So there were two shining stars, I guess. Well, I haven't really prepared what I was going to talk about the next time, so I guess that'll be a surprise for me and you, because I don't have anything kind of floating around in my head. It'll, of course, either be comics or a movie or something genre-related, but I've been really lagging on my movies because I just haven't had time. It's so hard to fit movies in, and honestly, I am such a Supernatural addict that it is hindering my movie watching, because when I come home in the early morning, like right now, it's about 2:45 in the morning. I just got home from work, and generally, I would be hanging out, and instead of putting a movie in to watch before I go to sleep, I wind up putting on Supernatural that I DVR'd off of TNT between 10 and 11, because I watched the first couple seasons, and we're into season 6 now, and then TNT keeps airing the episodes in order, so they just went back a little while ago to the pilot, and I thought it was a lot of fun to rewatch again all of the seasons from the pilot on, so I've been watching those faithfully. So I guess Supernatural has kind of hindered my movie watching, but lack of time too, because, I mean, most of the time I fall asleep. I've seen these episodes so many times I kind of crash out, but hopefully I can dig up a good movie. I have a couple movies coming from, I call him my eBay guy, is where I get my movies that are released overseas, the PAL version, you know, the ones, because I have a DVD player that plays all regions. So I actually have The Haunted University coming and I think Ghost Game is another one. The Loved Ones will be coming, and I'm really looking forward to Cold Prey 3. We'll see when that's coming out. He hasn't had any word on that, so hopefully for the next podcast I can review one of those movies, pop it in, and let you know what I think about some of that. So anyhow, I hope you enjoyed the rant on Kraven, and I wonder how many of you feel the same, or if I was just being a lunatic. But anyhow, until next time, have a good one.
Fucking everyone, the phone, Dick! Oh, fucker, where are you? You
did you really call the police?
You with your sorry ass, I did.
My mom and dad are gonna be so
mad. Thank you, Michelle. That was a joy to listen to, as always, but I definitely can echo your sentiments, and I won't say I warned you again, but I warned you. For the next movie, I'm going to talk about a 2009 film called Mutants that I finally caught up with. This one I'd heard lots of mixed things about, and they were pretty much right on. The movie essentially takes place in a world that's kind of on the edge of a post-apocalyptic scenario, and you're following Sonya and Marco, and they're basically just looking for a place to hide out and kind of regroup and recover, and with all the chaos going on around them, Marco has been infected. And it starts off as a two-person character study with Sonya trying to save Marco and then comfort Marco as he goes through the transformation, and then just trying to contain Marco until hopefully a cure can be found. And then you get introduced to all kinds of ugly, nasty, heartless characters who just really complicate things, and the whole thing turns into a downward spiral of, you know, men and women working against each other rather than with one another. I would say probably the first 20 minutes to half an hour of this film, I was somewhat engaged. I like these character studies, and I thought it was an interesting take on the whole zombie, mutant, you know, crazy, bloodthirsty creature subgenre, in the sense that you got to see a different side of it with Sonya being right there and kind of crumbling along with Marco's transformation and descent into his hideous form. But once the other characters were injected into the story, I really just thought the narrative became super muddled, and it just got really overbearing and monotonous for me. There are certainly, you know, elements that that were fun to watch, and if it could have been bookended, maybe with a more solid third act, a more interesting third act, it could have saved a lot of the clusterfuck that went on in the middle of the story. But for me, it was average at best. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 10. I can't recommend it on too many levels. There are some pretty good gore scenes. The film shot well, but again, I think it just suffers from a really messy and patchwork narrative. The writing is not good once you get into the second act and the conclusion of the story. So take it for what it's worth. I think it's streaming on Netflix now, so you know, you could take a peek at it and see what you think, and I'd be curious to hear some other opinions. But I don't have too many great things to say about Mutants. I'm going to wrap things up with a film that is getting ready to be released this year. It's making its festival run and raking in quite a few awards. Been assured by the director, who is Mike Flanagan, that we're going to be seeing some video on demand stuff for it, and you know, also a release at some point here soon. And that film is 2011's Absentia. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. I just kind of wanted to touch base on this one because I loved it so much, and also because I wanted everybody to be keeping an eye out for Absentia and for its release date. And I'll certainly update you as that becomes clearer, so you know when to look for it specifically. I sought out Mr. Flanagan on the recommendation of James DiPaolo, who had seen this film and told me that I really needed to see it and how fantastic it was. It's a two-character study, essentially, of Callie and Trisha. Callie's Trisha's younger sister, and Trisha has just come up on the seven-year anniversary of her husband Daniel's disappearance. And at that point, legally, she can file for the death certificate. And she's getting ready to do so, and also preparing to move out of the house she shared with her husband and kind of start anew. So Callie has come to help her tie up her loose ends and give her, you know, some moral and emotional support. Callie arrives, and Trisha mysteriously is, I would say, probably 8-9 months pregnant. Pretty big, and which kind of throws another monkey wrench in the situation, because obviously Daniel's been gone for 7 years, so there's some other stuff going on there. This is a really creepy movie. It gets under your skin. The performances are absolutely fantastic. I mean, beyond believable. The two actresses, Katie Parker, who plays Callie, and Courtney Bell, who plays Trisha, embody their characters so ferociously and fearlessly that I was totally sucked in to their trials and tribulations. Needless to say, Trisha's, you know, been being haunted by visions of her missing husband. There's a lot that's not right in the town that she lives in. And there is definitely a sinister supernatural presence here. She files for her husband's death certificate. It's accepted. Daniel's declared dead. And then he returns. And all hell breaks loose. Now, I'm not going to say any more than that. It's not a zombie film, so get that out of your head. Daniel does not come back as a zombie. But it's fantastic. It's a 10 out of 10 for me. I was riveted. And I'm hoping to have Katie Parker, Courtney Bell, and Mike Flanagan on the show soon to discuss this film and to correspond with its release. So look for that. I hope you enjoyed the show. And again, we're going to try to do that inside commentary before it inevitably gets remade in this country. You know, send us your feedback, conduitcast@gmail.com or 206-339-1819. And also keep checking theconduitspeaks.com. There's lots of content being added up over there, and you guys all take good care. Bye.